Okay. Let's get started if we can. My name is Jamie Dalton. I'm with Public Service Commission staff here today, and this is the time and place for the technical conference on the 2015 IRP, and I guess it's a chance for parties to ask questions of the company for DSM issues. So maybe before we get started, let's go around the room and have some introductions, and then I know there are a few folks on the phone as well too. So Bob, why don't we go ahead and start with you?
Bob Lively, Rocky Mountain Power.
Sophie Hayes, Utah Clean Energy.
Bela Vostok, Utah Office of Consumer Services.
Bill Como, Rocky Mountain Power.
Eli Morris, Rocky Mountain Power.
Brian Osborne, Rocky Mountain Power.
Michelle Beck, Office of Consumer Services.
Aaron Walkoviak, Rio Tinto.
Don Henderson, UAE.
Peter Ashcroft, Office of Energy Development.
Gavin Engelson, Office of Consumer Services.
Trisha. Oh, sorry, Trisha Schmidt, AG's Office Division.
Bob Davis with the Division.
Brenda Salter with the Division.
Cheryl Murray, Office.
Mark Peterson, Division.
Great. We have anybody on the phone?
Hi, this is Shannon Anderson with Tyler.
Okay.
Tony Franklin, UAE.
Marty Carroll, Lacey Purdue.
Try that again.
Eric Lacey, Purdue Court.
Thank you.
Marty Powell with the Division.
Anybody else? Okay, well, thank you. We'll pass the sign-up sheet around as well, too. Michelle, I'll start that with you. And Bob, we'll turn the time over to you and the company.
Okay, we've got here with us as we went around, Hui Xu, and I think you'll be leading, you know, our presentation. Is that correct?
Actually, Eli will be leading, but yes.
Oh, Eli will. Okay.
Introduce everyone.
Okay, Eli is here. And Hui Xu, and as we introduce Brian Osborne and Bill Coleman. So with that, I'll just turn the time to Eli, if you'd like to begin the presentation.
Yeah, I just want to add something, add to what Bob mentioned. So thank you for everyone come over here. And based on the comments we received, especially the comments we received from the last workshop, and looks like the parties are interested in knowing more about how we model DSM and the selection and the technical availability and how the in the how it fits in the preferred portfolio. So for that reason, the company and now we have today the subject expert in here, Bill Coleman and Eli Morris. They're from the DSM department of the company. So today the presentation will be by Eli, and we'll fill in some of the items like the points related to how we actually model in the IRP. So with that,
maybe Eli, before you get started as well too, just to note that we are streaming this, so be careful what you say because it's sensitive to picking up side conversations. So thank you.
I thought you were telling Eli to be careful.
No, Eli, we don't want you to necessarily be careful. So
all right, thanks, Sweet. For those of you I haven't met, I'm in our DSM planning department. I'm actually located out in Portland, but most of my work is on the east side of our system, the Pacific Coast system. And before I get started, I did want to thank everyone who submitted comments and questions. It really helped us focus the presentation on what was important to people. And so we have the presentation. There's also a handout with some additional material that is directed at some of the questions we received with more detail than we could put in the actual presentation. So I've attempted to cover as many of the questions in the presentation as possible, but hoping to have some additional time at the end for any additional questions there might be. So on the agenda, you'll see I've split it up into three different pieces here, different areas to cover. So we're going to talk some about the how the supply curves are developed for the IRP, then how DSM is valued and selected in the IRP, and some details on those selections. And then what does that mean in terms of our acquisition budget estimates to go acquire the IRP selections? So on to slide four, this is our, an overview of our DSM planning process, and I've put an oval there around the area we're going to be focusing on today. So we start with our potential study, which is managed by our DSM planning department, specifically me. We have that conducted by an independent third-party contractor selected through a competitive bidding process. Based on that, we develop supply curves for the IRP modeling. It's fed into the IRP model, which determines the achievable and cost-effective resources competing against other supply-side alternatives. And then based on those selections, then we look at, do we have the right programs in place to go acquire those? Do we need to modify those programs? Do we need to look into new programs within the DSM department? And then we go into the other phases of implementation, evaluation, reporting, and then it all feeds back to our next potential study, which we have been updating about every 2 years for each IRP cycle. So we can get the best information for each new IRP to inform the DSM selections. On to the next slide here. This is an overview of the 2015 potential study for DSM. So it's largely an update to the last study using newer, better data. Every time we do this, we try to use the best data available. In some cases, data haven't been updated since the previous assessment, since we're only doing them every 2 years. But we do find that we have changes in the company's load forecast, customer forecasts, there's new market research that's been done, new industry thinking on certain technologies, which we all try to incorporate, and also to account for what we've already done in the last 2 years through our DSM programs and what's been done through changes in codes and standards and other means of acquiring DSM. This study, we did have a new vendor, but the same general methodology, kind of an industry standard methodology for conducting these DSM potential studies. And then we had them go through and update all the data sources as appropriate. And then from that, we get new estimates of the resource potential, the quantities, and the costs. That's most of the items here that, as I think we've discussed before, and everyone's probably noticed, the Class 2 DSM potential did increase significantly from our last potential study. And the big driver for that is the LED lighting market. So based on new information and forecasts relative to our old study, there is just a lot more optimism in the industry, and we're already seeing it in the market that the efficacy is improving, they're available in more applications, especially these linear fluorescent replacement type, and that the cost is expected to decline significantly over time, which we're also already seeing. So when we look at the Class 2 DSM potential and selections relative to the last IRP, that is the single biggest driver, is the commercial LED market.
So Eli, I don't know if you're entertaining questions at this point, but just a question that I have. What are you seeing in changes of net to gross rates for that?
Well, we're going to have to look at that through our program evaluations. We don't assess those through the potential study. So the potential study is not, and I'm going to get to that in a couple slides when I get to achievability, but just to say that the potential study is looking at the gross savings available.
Okay.
So the net to gross will be assessed through our program evaluations.
I have a question on page four. And maybe you can probably just go on. So what's circled in red, does that mean that is your DSM department?
No, that's just more what I'm focusing on in the presentation today. So this is pretty much all DSM except for the upper right, which is the integrated resource plan. So everything else really is, and part of this, like new load forecast down in the lower right, part of that bullet is coming from our load forecasting department. But this is really our entire DSM planning cycle.
But just so I'm clear, so if you start from the upper left, mm-hmm. potential study, and as far as an IRP standpoint, you go through all the, what we're going to do, the potential, the achievable, and all that, and it ends up coming over here into the IRP as far as the decrease in load, right?
Well, so we, the DSM department, we do the potential study, develop the supply curves, provide it to Hui and her team for the modeling in the IRP. And then the IRP is going to do the selecting, determine what's cost effective, and then that becomes effectively another resource to decrease the load forecast, or not decrease, to meet the load forecast. But is that getting at your question?
No, I got a little bit confused there. So DSM, the supply curve model is like plus one and plus two, like it's supply resources, right? So the DSM doesn't end up, any of the DSM doesn't end up coming as a subtraction of the load, just DG, right?
Correct.
Right, it's a way to meet the load, yeah, like another supply side resource.
Is there a different fit into the supply curves, or is it, if I have a question about how they're priced differently, I can say.
I think that's the next slide, or.
Anyway, if you're getting to.
I'll get there, yeah. So I think we're on slide six now, so this is just a level set on terminology when you talk about potential. So the, we first start with technical potential, which is everything that's available to relative to the baseline forecast, just what's feasible to do, neglecting market barriers, neglecting cost effectiveness, just what's out there that could be done. So it's really a theoretical construct for the maximum available. And you'll find that in the potential study. The next phase is what we call the achievable technical of what could be done, what do we think is actually achievable in the market aside from cost effectiveness considerations. And I'm gonna, the next slide is on how we look at achievability. But so this is still before we screen for cost effectiveness, and this is also in the potential study. And this is what we provided the IRP for. The supply curves are achievable technical potential. Then within the IRP, they model our achievable technical potential versus other supply side resources, and they determine what's cost effective based on the value and need of the resource. So what we wind up with is what we think is achievable and economic. Those are the IRP selections. And the first handout is, it's not published in the IRP, but it's on the IRP website. I've included the link there. This is one of the questions we received on what percent of the achievable technical is selected by the model. So there are workbooks for every case within there are one workbook that includes tabs for every case within that was modeled in the IRP. This is from the preferred portfolio of what did we provide, what was selected, and what percent by state and year was selected. So on to the next slide on how we look at it.
One question on the technical. And the technical potential doesn't assume any sort of changes in technology. It's just based on the technology that's available today.
For the most part, the one exception is that because we did have national published forecasts of LED technology trend improvements, we don't tend to project either what might change in codes and standards or what technologies might be available. We have our vendor look at emerging technologies, but we really only model those that we think are really close to ready, where we can get savings and cost reliably. And LEDs is the one area where we have forecasts of what we thought was going to happen to the cost and efficacy of those, and we did incorporate those into the modeling. So how do we assess achievability of these resources? So class one and three DSM, first off, we assume that the existing products are going to continue at their current rates. So class one DSM, our load control, we model that, or the IRP team models it as an existing resource. So it doesn't go through the selection process. We assume that those savings are going to persist, that the programs will continue operating at those levels. Class three are our rate-based, like our time of use rates and our inverted block pricing, those savings we think are already captured in the load forecast because they've been offered historically. So those are also assumed to persist within the load forecast. And then we look at what incremental potential is available that we can give to the IRP for selection. So based on from that, we're looking at benchmarking against what other utilities have realized through their programs and what type of participation they've seen on their time of use rates, for example, or critical peak pricing rate. So it's really a benchmarking exercise to look at how much is available for new products that we might offer and how much remaining potential is there above and beyond what we're already capturing through our existing products. Class 2 DSM, we make the assumption that 85% of the potential can be achieved over 20 years. And it's an aggressive assumption. It's higher than what some utilities assume. We do it because on our system basis, we look to the Northwest Power and Conservation Council in some of our states, and that's their assumption. And it's important to the third bullet here is that 85% is not necessarily all coming in through utility programs. So the 85% just assumes this could be captured somehow. It might come in through improved codes and standards, market transformation. If rates go up, you might see just conservation that customers are pursuing or other naturally occurring methods. So the 85% is not, we don't know if it's gonna come in through, if we're gonna have to pay for it or not, especially over the long term. And then that second bullet was just that 81% is what we ultimately got to in this study, just because there are some lost opportunities. If you don't install a high efficient heat pump in the second year and it has a 20-year life, you have to wait until outside the IRP window to reinstall it, for example. We call those lost opportunities. So we're a little under the 85% over 20 years. And then just for context here, in our 2007 DSM potential study, we actually had the vendor survey our customers on how likely they would be to participate at different incentive levels. And at 50%, which was the midpoint, assuming the company paid 50% of the incremental cost of the measure, we got on average about 55% achievability. So that's just one point to look at. When we think about the 85%, we think that what comes in through utility programs might be something lower than that. We don't know what codes and standards are gonna do going forward, which can really drive how much is available for utility programs.
And Eli, that was that 50%, right, was all assumed cost effective with the company contributing 50%?
I'm not sure if that was in the question, but the assumption was that, right, we would be offering cost effective incentives for cost effective measures that, yeah.
Yeah, this is already on the phone. How does the 85% relate to what's in the IRP, the levels that the company wants to achieve?
What's in the IRP is the 85%. So we applied the 85% or the 81% here. That's what our achievable technical is based on, and then we gave it to the IRP. The IRP.
So that's what you gave to the IRP,
yes.
But in terms of the portfolio and its choice, how does that 85% relate to what the portfolio has embedded in?
Well, and I think we saw something like the IRP is selecting about 80% of what we provided it.
On average, Artie, they gave a handout here that shows the percentage by state by year, and that's on their IRP website. So, but I will observe that in the out years, in both Utah and Wyoming, it selected more than 85%. So I'm wondering, if you only gave it 85%, how could it select more than 85%? That's the percent of the 85%.
Yeah, so
yeah.
If you multiply this percent
by
the 81%, you'll get what percent of the technical potential was selected by the IRP. So something like 80% of 80%. 65% of the technical potential was selected by the IRP.
Another thing to think about the out years is that there's a lot less DSM available because there was no assumption of technology changes, so that it's a percentage of a lesser amount.
Yep. So on the next slide, 8, this is where we're on the question about how we model the class 2 supply curves in each state. So they do differ by state, and this is because we need to align how the IRP selects the resources with how we justify cost recovery for our programs in each state. So what we've done, the methodology is the same as the 2013 IRP. We have 27 different cost bundles in each state. They're in $10 per megawatt hour levelized cost increments, up to $200 per megawatt, and then they get in bigger chunks because the model doesn't tend to select up that high. So we have less granularity up there. And then you can see here, so in Utah, we're looking on a utility cost basis. There are certain credits applied within the IRP model, T&D deferral benefits, risk mitigation benefits. In all of our other states, we're looking at some variant of the total resource cost test. In some cases, we have assumed non-energy benefits, a 10% conservation credit that we apply in the Northwest. But this is to show that the levelized costs will differ from state to state based on the guidance we have in each state on how to recover the costs of our programs. And this is also one of the pieces that informs what percent, when we look at the percent selected by the IRP, that's one piece that will dictate how much, just depending on, based on which state we're in, the levelized costs will be different based on the modeling methodology. Okay, so now we're going to move on to valuation and selection within IRP. I'm going to turn it over to Queen for a couple slides.
Okay, thanks, Eli. So this is, I will give a brief overview of how the DSM, cost to DSM are modeled in IRP. And Brian is with me, and then Brian will fill in the deep questions about any details of how exactly the models work. So we have received the comments. Among the comments, the question was, did we change our methodology from 2013 IRP to 2015 IRP? The quick answer to that would be no, we didn't change anything. So this time, I think the question probably came from the fact that people saw we have more than classical BSM select in the preferred portfolio than in the 2013 IRP. And that is entirely because what Eli explained, this time the technical achievable is higher than in the past. So we took the technical, the achievable level into from the DSM group. Then the data came in as the terminology is supply curves. So the supply curve will touch on the cost of the DSM programs and also the shape of the DSM programs. So the DSM group, they studied 50,000 some measures, and those are all grouped into cost bundles by state. So we in IRP, we ended up modeling 27 bundles for each state. And for the state of Washington, because of the transmission constraint, we broke Washington into two. So we modeled 7 times 27 bundles in the IRP. So the profiles of those bundles will dictate like the capacity contribution of those resources and how much energy they will have from those programs. Then the cost of those bundles, like you I mentioned earlier, we will add in, will reduce the cost for the for several credits. The first credit is the T&D credit, based on assumption the DSM programs could delay or defer some of the company's investment on transmission and distribution assets. So that's that credit. Then the next credit is, since the cost of DSM resource will be already reduced load, so you will reduce volatility. Since in the IRP, we do model stochastic load and risk, and together with the market price and all those risks. So with the load being reduced, so the assumption is the risk of a portfolio will reduce. So we add on a stochastic risk reduction credit. Then in Oregon and Washington, we added another 10% of credit based on market. So that's based on the rules and regulations in the states.
So we just a question on the stochastic risk. So how is that realized in terms of a credit or a reduction in risk in the modeling?
It becomes a reduction to the cost that Eli's group sent us. So the determination of the credit is basically, it's based on a study.
So does that change like the like the upper tails or of the distribution of risk then? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's not a changing in the risk itself. We convert it into a dollar amount. And the dollar amount is a direct reduction to the cost okay. that PSM group provided us. So basically, with all these three credits, the cost of those bundles are lower than what PSM group gave us.
Is the cost reduction the same for every bundle?
No, it depends on the shape.
For the risk credit, it is the same. But for the other credits, it depends on the shape. So the T&D credit is based on the hourly shape that they give us. And then we back into a dollar per megawatt. But the stochastic risk is just applied across the board, singly on every bundle.
So in other words, when the draws, the random draws of a Monte Carlo simulation, or whatever it is, still is the same then. It's just the cost is reduced then.
Correct.
Yes.
Okay.
Just so I'm clear, you're saying that the you're only reducing the cost. You don't ever increase it on in your stochastic impacts.
That's correct. This credit is to capture, I mean, in essence, if we reduce load, I mean, we have Monte Carlo draws. Each draw, the load will fluctuate. So with this reduction, because of DSM, the fluctuation becomes smaller. So based on that theory, we're saying like we gave a credit for the reduction in load. So this is not reflected. The Monte Carlo draws are still the same. And the Monte Carlo draws are the same, and then those draws still apply to the same load forecast. There's no change on that side. Only the cost of the DSM resources are lower. So previously it's $100 per megawatt hour, I'm making up an example arbitrarily, $100 per megawatt hour for this program. Because of this program will eventually reduce load, just given the concept of DSM. Concept of DSM is a direct reduction of load. So the load is lower. However, in our Monte Carlo study, the load still fluctuates as they are, since we did not reduce load itself. So load is still the same. Then this DSM program will say the DSM program actually do reduce load, but we're not reflecting the reduction in load itself. So we're giving the credit, a dollar credit, to the program. I'm not sure if that answered the question. That doesn't sound like.
We actually run a separate study before we even get into the process of the IRP. To come up with this figure, and we do a stochastic study where we do it with and without the full set of DSM in order to figure out what this risk value would be. And then we're applying kind of a benefit then to all DSM under this assumption that you're reducing load. And so there's a benefit that's not really captured in the cost we receive from the DSM team. So that's the theory.
Is that study on the IRP website?
The study itself is not there. The discussion about how it's calculated, it's in our report. How the credit is calculated.
In the DSM potential study or the?
No, it's in the IRP report.
In the IRP report.
Oh, it's
in part of the
documentation.
It's in the IRP. I can
give you the page number when I find it.
Okay.
Okay, so the let's see, I will try to, so like in the IRP study, the Monte Carlo draws happens in the process. We have a deterministic study, then we have a stochastic study. So we use the planning and the risk model, so it's what we refer to as PAR. So we run the deterministic, in deterministic mode with the DSM program and without the DSM program. Then we say, what's the difference between the system cost between the two? Right? Then we run in stochastic mode with DSM, without DSM. Then we calculate the difference between system and cost. Then we compare the two differences. So the two differences, then is converted, then divided by the DSM, megawatt hours converted into like this credit. So that's the math.
So all of these credits, just ballpark, what are they, how much are they approximately?
Yeah,
I think it's in the RP, but I don't know.
It's in the RP. The stochastic credit is about $4, since that's the same for all cost bundles. Then the TND will be, it varies depending on the shape of the, and the size of the bundle. So is the interesting. So the, it's, I'm not sure if we have a number for
it. $5 per bundle?
The TND credit can get to be, and it's not per megawatt hour, it's per megawatt, or per kW actually is what we calculate, so I think it ends up being.
Yeah, it's probably need to go into the details and see,
It can range quite a bit because we're converting it to a per kW figure, and some of these DSM programs are really low megawatts or kilowatts. You know, they might be very peaky, so they end up getting a bigger transmission and distribution credit in that case because of the way it's calculated for that shape. So it does vary quite a bit.
Is the method for calculating the TND credit similar?
Same as in the PSOP?
No, similar to the risk reduction credit?
The risk reduction credit that's calculated as I mentioned, like it's actually model one of it. The TND is the TND credit is calculated entirely based on the profile of the bundles,
and so it's done per bundle.
Correct. So let's then that's the cost of the DSM as input to the IRP modeling. Then also the achievable potential is the input to the IRP modeling, which include the size in terms of the megawatt, the capacity, and also the amount of energy from the program. So with that, we put it into System Optimizer, the model. That model we use to select resources. So the DSM will go into the model the same as all supply side resources. Earlier, the ask about whether we net against the model. No, we don't. We only net the distributed generation from the node. So the class 2 DSM go into the model, basically it's one of the resources that happens to be called a class 2 DSM, and it happens to have certain characteristics which can connect against the mode, against our planning reserve margin requirement. But other than that, it's just one of the resources we model.
So just to clarify, that's except class 3 DSM, right? Which is assumed existing and lower.
Right, the existing program, as you mentioned, is captured in the model. We don't model additional costs in the DSM. In the IRP, we do have a sensitivity, saying that what the cost is under the company's control, what it will be. But that's just a sensitivity. In the EPA, we don't have additional costs in the DSM.
Also, do you remember what was the percentage in the 2013 IRP? Compared to the 81% in this year, what was the
2000? It was very close, right around the 80 also, I'd say. I'd have to go look at the last study, but it doesn't change significantly. We still use the 85%, so it's something a little below 85%.
Any other questions on slide 10?
Okay, so on the transmission and distribution credit, it varies. What would be the low and what would be the high range?
Yeah, it's hard to tell without, I don't have it memorized. I don't know if Brian, you have it memorized.
Yeah.
27 multiplied by 7, so that's a hard, that's how many bundles we modeled.
Guessing, I'd say anywhere from $20 to $70. It's a can be, but it's per kW. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, so if you need that number, we can go take a look at it.
Yeah, we do have that, so we could, but I'm just guessing off the top of my head. I know I've seen kind of in those ranges.
Anything on slide 10? We're on to slide 11. Slide 11 is basically, the slide 10 is about how we constructed the inputs to the models, and the slide 11 is about how the model actually uses the information. So as I mentioned earlier, BSM resources, the cost, the size, the megawatt, and the megawatt hours, they are all input to a model in the same way as all supply side resources. Then in the SO model, the system optimizer model, it will select the bundles at a various state and at a various cost levels based on the economics and the location and the characteristics of the bundles. Since some of the bundles may be towards more peakier, like during summertime, or some of them may be more like a flat, and just different shapes. So the model will consider that and select the resources. Then this is in SO model. Then after the SO model selected those bundles, then we use the PAR model, the planning and the risk model, to evaluate the risk profile of a portfolio. In those runs, we treated the class 2 BSM, those selected class 2 BSMs, as must run resource. Since it's selected, they will reduce load, they must run. So, and in the preferred portfolio, you can see that in the near future, in the action plan period, the near like two to four years, that time period, the class 2 BSM was selected, and at the same time, the front office transactions were not maxed out. So that could imply if the BSM resources do not show up as a selected amount, the company can always use the front office transaction to cover the resource shortage.
That's a good question. I think I might have missed the implication of what you said. So in the PAR model, when you model the class 2 as must run, does that actually reduce load in PAR?
Eventually, effectively, it would.
Okay.
Since it basically say, here's a load, and here's a resource, you have it. So the net of it is a reduction in load.
Okay.
So although it doesn't really subtract it from load, it's the rest of the resource portfolio will need the net of the two.
Yes.
The question, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Okay. Try to give a long answer, then the answer is yes. So the as I mentioned, in the short run, the front office transaction can fill the gap if there will be any. And in the long run, the company basically will reveal whether it's 85% achievable or 83% achievable. And also, company has a integrated resource plan every other year. And also, we have update in between, so company can always review the resource selection during that time. So I probably want to go back to what Eli handed out, the handout number one. I can just add some meaning to the table. So this is a table produced after each run for all the cases we run and all the sensitivities we run. This table will be available. So the very top section is what's been selected, analytical energy, in terms of megawatt hours. Megawatt hours is selected by the SO model, by state, by year. So these are incremental amounts selected by the model. So the middle table is what Eli described as the achievable potential. So the these the middle, basically the middle table are the data Eli handed to us, and we put in as the upper limit of the cost of the other.
That's the economic.
That's the achievable.
Economic. Right. So that's at any cost. That's everything in the supply curves, all the way up to our, whatever our maximum cost is.
So the economic will be the top box, the top table. So that's based on economics, the SO model selected those.
But I thought this top box was what was selected by the model.
Correct, based on economics.
Right, the top box is the selections, the second box is what we provide, the achievable technical before the economic screening.
Do you have any data on what percentage of the economic potential was selected?
100%.
Right, the economic potential is what was selected. That's what we...
I thought the economic potential was derived by using things like the utility cost test and the customer cost test.
It is. So when we develop the supply curve, so this second box, that's just the quantity, that's the megawatt hours, but along with that, for each of the 27 cost bundles, we give them the cost of it. So for each of the 27 Utah cost bundles, we're saying the average cost of this bundle is X dollars per megawatt hour. And that dollars per megawatt hour is developed based on the methodology from slide 8. So that's where we look at for each measure, what is the cost, assuming, what are we assuming the incentive would be, the administrative cost, that utility cost estimate. The IRP team then applies their credits, and we get to the cost of the bundle, and that's what the IRP uses to determine what's economic.
This is the, I just try to add this and see if it helps. Since whether it's economically achievable or not, the economy is relative to something. So in that case, in my mind, the selection by the SO model will be the economic achievable, since that's based on economics relative to other resources, if it makes sense.
And it kind of is a little bit confusing because sometimes we're used to thinking of the technical potential, the achievable potential, and the economic outside of the SO model. And so in this case, they're using the SO model to decide what's economic, what it selects. So it's different than the way we've traditionally often talked about these categories. So yeah, I don't know if that helps at all.
Right, many potential studies, and even ours in 2007, you would go technical, you would screen that for economics, you'd have your economic, and then you'd say what percent of that is achievable, and you get to your achievable economic. But because we don't know the value of the potential, we can't screen it before we run it through the IRP. We allow the IRP to optimize around it and determine what is economic relative to other supply side options.
So in Utah, we have the utility cost test, but in the other states, there's the customer cost and the utility cost test. So I was curious to know if it's possible that in this modeling procedure for DSM resource to be screened out at the customer cost level when it passed through the utility cost level.
Yes.
So
and just
where,
to be clear, we're not.
We're in the process with that.
So the supply curves are specific to each state. So when we look at one of the other states, we're developing the supply curve costs based on the total resource cost test. So for the same measure, if it had the same savings, and sometimes they don't, just based on climate or whatever, but if they did, then we would give them, that measure might be in a different bundle, a different cost bundle in different states. In one state, it might be in the $20 to $30 cost bundle, and in another state, it might be in the $80 to $90 cost bundle. And so the model might select it in one state and not in the other, just based on the cost effectiveness criterion we need to use in each state.
So the cost test then and it sounds like it's maybe different in one talking about it one way and then talking about a model. But so you're not really screening out any ESM bundles in when you're applying these cost tests. You're just deciding which bundle to put them in.
Exactly, right. The, when we apply the cost test, that's determining the levelized costs to tell us which of the 27 bundles the measure goes in.
Okay. So there's nothing, as far as the IRP modeling goes, there's nothing eliminated from the technically achievable potential with the cost test. All you're doing with the cost test is deciding which bundle goes, and then the model decides whether it's...
Exactly. That second table on handout one is everything at any cost. That's the achievable technical across all 27 cost bundles. We give it all to them. Then the model selects based on where it falls, which cost bundle it's in, and the value of the cost bundle.
Okay. But John, you know, I think there is something that maybe you were on the edge of raising, and that is the fact that different states have different tests means the same measure is cost different amounts. And some, it could that, as well as maybe just the nature of the load and so what is the potential, is going to skew where it gets selected from. So you can look at, like I was just doing a little bit of calculation here on the side, and if you look at these tables, you can see that the amount of DSM selected from Utah, at least in 2016, 2020, the 2 years I looked at, is we're providing a much higher percentage of the DSM selected than our load is of the total system. And I feel like I'm making a little mental note that could have MSP implications.
Okay. Can I just follow up? So you're looking at, Michelle, you're looking at the incremental DSM savings compared to the total?
I just did a simple percentage, and I took the Utah number divided by the system number and came up with what the percent is, and I just happened to know what our percent of the system is, approximately. So, for example, well, now, I certainly can't see that small of a number. I think it was about, well, yeah, and I can't read that small of a number, but maybe it was 51%-ish that of the total in 2016 that Utah KWH of and WH of total system is about 51%, 57% in 2020, or about 42% of the system.
Michelle, I just did a quick and dirty going to the total column.
Oh, you did the total?
Or about 56%.
So I'm not trying to derail your meeting, and I think it's outside the scope of this meeting, but I do think that it's an important consideration for other ongoing processes.
Well, I'm not sure it is outside, because I've been concerned with this issue for a long time, the fact that we are, and I know it has to do with some regulatory constraints, but I'm not sure there's ever been an ask to see if you could model, you know, compare supply-side resources in the IRB, because effectively in Utah, that's what you're doing. You're comparing DSM as a supply-side resource. You're saying these are the utility costs to serve, and in the other states, you're using these are the utility costs and these are the participant costs. And so I think going forward.
But it's more complicated than that, because in some states, when you look at the TRC, it brings in a bigger set of benefits.
Okay.
So
yeah.
It could lower costs, whereas in some it could raise costs. I mean,
okay.
It's even bigger than what.
So there are some, but in the IRP, it would be nice if we could model it consistently based on the utility pace.
And then there's still an issue that's outside the IRP, which is to the extent that you're selecting more, you're creating a potential rate burden on that state. If you select more DSM that for let's just use Utah. If you select 55% of the class one DSM comes from Utah, but only 42% of the load is from Utah, and we're paying for that site is assigned and we pay for it all in the year that it's acquired, you're creating a rate burden on Utah that is not, I think, reflected
oh, yeah.
in our MSP calculations.
And there probably are some MSP implications, but there's also, we have to look at both sides, the rate burden and then also the other benefits that it may bring. It may reduce our Quincent T overall. You know, it's complex, as you know.
It is. Yeah, it is.
So, don't say there's not MSP implications unless you want to come to all those meetings.
No, I didn't say there was
yeah.
an MSP.
Yeah.
There's MSP implications. It could be plus and minus.
Yeah, and I think Michelle, you're really looking at least in my mind, MSP, not to get too far afield either, but you're looking at megawatt hours and you're looking at megawatts, basically.
Right. Megawatt hours is very different than megawatts. There's not going to be any MSP benefits really in that megawatt hours as compared to megawatts. So
because 75% of the allocation is megawatt or something, or the way it's in that model, but, in the GEM model.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're looking at some of the different, the SG factor in particular. You know, and how that affects, it comes up in my mind anyway with MSP, how that's formulated. But that is beside the point a little bit.
Yeah, so now I have derailed your meeting. I see all these folks are like,
it's a different group of people.
Yeah, and I recognize that. I just thought that while the Utah parties are all in the room, we could just touch on that, but I don't mean to derail you. Please go out to your
own. They're good points.
I'm glad you mentioned it. At least we know that's something parties we want to talk about more.
But in a different form.
Not here, not IRP treats the system as a whole. So we meet the resource need of a total company.
Right.
So we select resource, whether it's on the east or on the west side, for the system.
But I still think this is an issue for the next IRP, is how we model DSM processes in the system optimizer model.
I understand. I mean, you touched on this when you talked about the different ways we do the costs for each state, and I thought it's actually related to how we get recovery in those states.
Exactly.
So it is consistent.
Right, because you can't. I feel like you. I understand your point, but you can't. Let's just say, as a theoretical example, in another state, like just state A is just using the utility cost test, and state B is using a TRC, and it results in the exact same measure being $20 in one state and $40 in another state, just as a theoretical example. So I understand your wish to model them at the same cost, but we can't, because those reflect the actual prices. Because of the regulatory treatment.
So it's not the actual price, it's the regulatory treatment. So if you were to say in Oregon, up to this cost would pass the total resource cost test, and then in the IRP say, but the utility isn't paying that whole cost, they're only paying this cost, then you would use the TRC to see what's cost effective, but you wouldn't model the whole resource cost.
Okay, I see your point. Yeah, I see your point. But you still have to constrain based on what would pass.
And you, it's not simple. I'm not saying.
Yeah.
But you can't. But you don't have to include the utility as paying that cost because they're not. It's tricky, but we can talk for the next IRP and see if there's some way to get around it.
Yeah, I think it's a question of what benefit we get from that, because we're really just, or they are really just comparing the cost between portfolios. So they're not really looking at, I think your point is that we may not have the right PBRR, right, the revenue requirement, but when you compare the portfolios, they're consistent.
No, I think your point is it doesn't select correctly because you priced it incorrectly, and you should screen based on what would pass in the individual states. So you don't allow the model to select something that couldn't pass the state's DSM screening, but you also have to price it based on what the actual cost to the utility would be, not what the costs that it's screened on are.
Exactly. Thank you for making that clear. We can talk about this. So I think
it's a discussion for another day. Yeah. We wanted to present how we've done it in the last two IRPs. And we've tried to be transparent about this throughout. That slide we presented last July in the IRP public process.
So anyhow, just to try to finish up this, I think it's, I'm repeating what people already know. So on this handout, again, at the very bottom is a percentage of selected, percentage of potential that's been selected. So then one goes by the potential is actually the 80-some percentage of the technical potential. So that's that table. And the very last bullet on slide 11 is, my understanding is there were comments about like the Beckman study. So here, this bullet will just cover what Beckman study is about. So Beckman study, is, earlier we talked about 27 bundles per state and actually 54 for Washington. But aside from that, we model 27 bundles per state. It's at a pretty high level, and it's just cost bundles. Here's a Utah cost bundle ABCD. But in the bundles, there are various types of end use programs. So when the DSM companies, DSM group, ELIS group, when they go out to acquire resources, they need more detailed information. It's not like they don't acquire resources by cost bundles. They acquire resources by end use. So for that reason, we perform Beckman study, meaning what if we don't have a particular resource in the portfolio. So we decrement the available, achievable, available potential by that particular resource. Since now, again, we want to get more detailed information, and we use a different type of grouping for the DSM resources. So what we call it a resource group. So we study 17 resource groups. So each group is a collection of end use measures, however other terminologies are used. Basically, a type, multiple DSM resources which have a similar shape. So in this detailed study, we mainly evaluate the shape, the impact of the resources based on their shape. So what we did is all of the technical achievable potential. We say this particular group of resources is not available. So then we study the impact of that to the system cost. So then the difference between with and without that group of resources determines the definite value of the of that group of resource. Or you may consider that avoid cost. If we have the resource, we avoid the system cost. So that's a decrement study.
And what do you do with the decrement study?
The decrement study tells us the value of Class II DSM, which we then use to assess the cost effectiveness of our programs and measures and portfolios.
Yeah, I'm sure Eli would like us to study every single measure, like 50,000 of them, but we can't do that. So we group them into just by the shapes and all that. So that's the decrement study.
So that happened. That's not an input into the IRP, that happens after.
Correct. After the IRP, we perform that. So of the preferred portfolio, what if this is not available?
Okay.
And you do that overall, all programs, not by bundle or shape?
But no, it's all of the, like not also 27 bundles anymore. So it's like all the bundles, it's grouped by resource type, a shape. So. A group of resources, they may come out of different bundles now. So it's like also like a matrix. Here's a bundle, here's a resource group. And get from there. So that's the end of how we model it and how the input were put together, how SO and PAR studies were done in the IRP process. Questions? Okay. Feel free.
Okay, so just going back to the decrement part, the decrement study. So that's done after the IRP. So is that information used for the next IRP or the IRP update?
No, we don't use that information. That information is created basically for mainly for Eli's group when we go out to acquire.
Okay.
It's not sorry.
Yeah. So that helps you determine which end measures to pursue because the benefits.
It's both. Ones are, well, so when we look at change updates to programs or new programs, we will run cost effectiveness analysis. And when we file for program changes, we'll include that and the different tests. And these are the values we use to assess whether they're cost effective. Or if you look at our 2014 annual report, you'll see our cost effectiveness results by program, and those are using the 2013 decrement values, 2013 IRB decrement values. That's how we determine the value of the DSM to compare to the costs to acquire it. So it's both prospective looking and retrospective. Okay, so on the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about the actual selections in a preferred portfolio now that we gave you the background on how the model selects it. So we got some questions on what we looked at it for class one DSM. So we did look at three different products, same as the as what we assessed and modeled in the 2013 potential study in IRP. So we looked at direct load control of air conditioners, primarily residential, but also in small commercial. They would have residential type air conditioning equipment, commercial curtailment products, and then irrigation load control. So two of those are already offered in Utah. One would be a new program. And then for the two that are offered, we looked at what remaining potential is there above what we already have in place. Then we, as part of the process, when we start the potential study, we ask our vendor to go look at what products we should be modeling here. So they did a review of what's out there in the market and determined we should model those three, but they also looked at these next three just to see if they were worth including for a more quantitative assessment. And they determined that for various reasons, it wasn't appropriate to include these in the potential study at this time, maybe, and it's something we'll look at in the next study. But so they did look at smart appliance direct load control, FAST-DR, it's also called demand response for ancillary services, and then thermal energy storage. And so for various reasons, mostly because either there isn't a lot of data out there, or the cost is really high, or they're low potential, or possibly that we've already captured the likely potential in one of our other products, which we know will be cheaper. So for example, with FAST-DR, there were a number of reasons, but one of them was we think these customers, if a commercial curtailment product was in place, that's where they would participate, and that's a lower cost resource. So one of the things we have to do in the potential study when we prepare the supply curves is to address the interactive effects and try to, for programs that compete against each other, determine where customers would participate. And so if we can do that pre-screen, it makes it easier for us to actually quantify the potential and to model it, so we don't have to say X percent would do commercial curtailment and Y percent would do the FAST-DR when we model it in the IRP.
Yeah, I have a question. I've been doing, it's probably dangerous to be reading, but I've been doing reading about LED lighting control in the commercial sector. Is that included in the smart appliance, or is that a new program that hasn't been looked at yet?
That probably would not be included in there. I'd have to go back and look at the detail, and I included the reference here in the potential study. Because we really locked down this analysis at the beginning of 2014. So by the time we get to this process, it's almost a two-year process to do each of these studies. So we do have to lock down the assumptions well before we actually get to the IRP modeling, but that's something we'll look at for our next study. And then in terms of the selections, as I mentioned before, we assume that existing programs continue at existing levels. They're modeled as existing resources. They're not optimized in the model. So we have 115 megawatts of Poolkeeper and 20 megawatts of irrigation load control in Utah in the preferred portfolio. And then there was no new class one resources selected until 2033, when there's about 5 megawatts of Poolkeeper selected. So in the near term, we're not seeing a need for either for a new commercial curtailment program or for real expansion of our two existing programs.
So the IRP is a system, and so we really have three existing programs, right? Because you have
right.
Idaho
yep.
irrigator. And then have you given it when it selects new resources or has the opportunity to select new resources, is it just expansion of those three existing programs, or is it, or have you given it the option to look at, I don't know, like an irrigator load control program in Oregon? I don't even know if you have enough irrigation load in Oregon that would be a thing. But.
We did. So these three programs were modeled in all of the states, were given to the IRP, and I don't have the selection table here, but it did select in around 2022 an irrigation program in Oregon, and then load control after commercial curtailment in Oregon in 2023, I think. So it is looking at that based on the regional constraints. So it is, yes. So, and this is specific to Utah. We do have also the, as you mentioned, the Idaho irrigation load control as an existing resource.
For Eli, just to clarify this, the three bullets under, the three sub-bullets under the second bullet, those don't even go into the technical potential.
That's right.
They're just.
We had them look at them, and it was more of a qualitative screening of is it worth trying to assess the costs and potential in this study or not.
So the bottom line is that the IRP that is selecting is too expensive.
In Utah, I didn't select any new until 2033 either. It's a mix of need and value and cost. So essentially, it's not cost effective either because the need isn't there or the value isn't there, or it's the cost isn't justified by the need and value.
Well, there's need for capacity, but the cost must be too high.
Yeah, one of the most broad analysis that we have, and we have other resources available.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes?
Can you have an example of what would be the past beyond how it differs from commercial development?
Well, and I'm definitely not an expert on it, just because we didn't go into it as much, but my understanding is it's really designed to meet to have very quick response to events, even on a sub-minute basis, to meet utility needs. And so commercial curtailment would be more, I think you would give either day-ahead notice or several-hour notice to customers. So it's not quite designed to meet very quick needs in the market, on the utility system. Fast DR would be more. And I think that's why you need more infrastructure around it and why the costs are higher, because you need to be able to respond almost instantaneously to needs. So on to the next slide is class two in the preferred portfolio. So the graph there is showing the incremental selections in Utah by year. And we got some questions around the shape of this on a year-to-year basis, and that's what I've tried to address here. So the first thing, we see selections increasing for about 5 years, and then we see a drop. And that's mostly driven by two factors. One is the backstop provision of the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, or ESA here, requires that the residential lighting general service standards are going to improve again. And there's some uncertainty around that, because it is just a backstop. If no other legislation is passed, and there's discussion over what's actually going to happen, but that's what we're modeling, assuming that stays in place, and effectively compact fluorescent light bulbs will become the minimum standard. It's not exactly there, but that's currently the only technology aside from LEDs that will meet that standard. So that's what we assumed in the potential study. So the lighting potential really drops, because now you're comparing LEDs to a CFL baseline instead of an ESA compliant baseline of today. And then also on our measure ramp rates, we have some on pretty aggressive ramp rates. Those are the rates that assume what rate we could acquire each of these resources at. And there are some that are, the assumption is you could acquire them over 5 years. So after 5 years, that potential is exhausted, and that's another reason we drop off in the sixth year. And then similarly, after another 5 years, we have more measures that are assumed to be exhausted, and these are measures, I use the term discretionary here. I use lost opportunity before. Those are really our two resource classes. The discretionary is what's out there in existing buildings today that you could go retrofit. And lost opportunities depend on equipment turnover and new construction. There's a certain time when you can intervene in the market. So discretionary resources, a lot of them are on a 10-year ramp rate, so they're exhausted at that point. And then also we have the equipment turning over in our model and being upgraded over time. And over 10 years, most of the equipment has been assumed to be replaced with more efficient equipment. And that's another reason why the potential drops off and just continues to decline from there.
And what accounts for the increase between 2020 and 2024?
So we, one is that this assumed improvement in LED efficacy and decrease in cost. So we're actually, the LED savings is increasing. So we're seeing more potential because the technology is improving and the cost is coming down, which makes it more likely to be selected. And then also just because of the ramp rates on some of those lost opportunity measures, we're continuing to get more and more as the equipment turns over. Are the two primary factors.
So Eli, on the second bullet, so is this trying to say that, so what some of the DSM majors are upgrading equipment more efficient maybe before it's would have been retired or changed out anyway?
We don't tend to look at, I was just gonna say, we don't tend to look at early replacement of equipment. We will look at retrofits. But typically, like when we're looking at lighting, we're assuming that when the bulbs burn out, you could get someone to install a more efficient LED instead of a linear fluorescent tube, for example.
I guess my question is that you're assuming that some equipment will be upgraded outside of the DSM program?
There is some of that in the baseline forecast.
Okay.
Yes.
That's fine.
Yep. Just based on current market shares that equipment turns over in the baseline forecast. Or, yeah.
And then Eli, I would just add one other reason to this. I don't think it's a bad reason. It's because it's hard to predict, but there's no really assumption aside from your LED assumptions for new technologies.
Right.
In the 20-year horizon.
Yep. Over the, yeah, and that's, right. We know there will probably be more potential out there, and that's why we do the studies every 2 years, but we just don't know what it will be, what it'll cost, and we don't feel like we should include it for the resource planning purposes. Yeah. The next slide is just a comparison between the last three IRPs, really the 2011, the 2013 update, and the 2015, the selections. And this is exactly to that point that we have more certainty in the short term. Over the long term, things can really change from study to study. In the orange is the 2011. The red, we really saw a decrease in potential as some new standards came on, and we weren't yet seeing the forecast in the market for what LED lighting would do. Now we updated the study, and the big change there a lot of things changed when we looked at the newest latest and greatest information, but a big one was the LEDs that we just weren't forecasting nearly that amount in on the red line. Now we're up at the blue. And the green is showing you our actual historical acquisitions. And you'll remember we had that the accelerated action plan on the last IRP, which is one of the reasons why we're above the IRP selections back then. But this is really to show that these numbers bounce around, especially in the long term. It's why we evaluate it on a rolling basis and keep updating to try to get the best information available, especially in the short term for IRP modeling. Okay, we're gonna move on to the acquisition budgets. Any questions on anything so far on evaluation or selection on IRP? Okay, and we can certainly ask them to come up. I guess just to look at the handout, you can see that information is all relative to the sections we already covered. So the achievable technical potential is by year in Utah and sector and end use is the second handout. The third one are the selections by sector for Utah and each year for class two. That really shows that we're seeing a huge potential in commercial, and a lot of that is in lighting. And then the last one is a little more granular data to the graph. So that's the achievable technical by year. Oh, these are the selections, sorry, not achievable technical. Selections by year, by sector, by end use. To give you some idea of where we're seeing those, the selected resources in the IRP. Okay, so on to slide 16, this is an overview of how we develop these budgets. We got some questions about how the budgets come out of the IRP. What does it mean if our budget estimates change relative to what does that mean for IRP selection? And I wanted to emphasize here that it's really two distinct processes. The IRP selects the amount of resources, and then the DSM department goes and estimates what it would take to acquire those resources. Because the IRP is looking at it on a levelized basis. It's using some generalized assumptions from the potential study on average incentive amounts, average administrative costs. And when we look at it, we go more looking at how we would actually go and acquire the resources identified and what the cost would be. So we look at what our historical costs have been, what we see going forward into the future, both what we're seeing in the field and what the potential study is showing, and then other factors, market conditions to estimate the budgets. And we did provide a preliminary estimate of the budgets in the IRP Appendix B, which I have on the next slide, and then we're going through the process of updating those, which we shared with our DSM steering committee last month, and we got a request to include that in here. So we also have the updated estimate here. So slide 17, this is what is in you'll see in IRP Appendix D, our preliminary look at the budget to acquire the resources selected in the preferred portfolio. But really, we want to get on to the next slide, because after that, we took a closer look as part of our business planning process, because that was really a very high level look on based on historical costs to give a very preliminary estimate, and knowing that we would be updating it within the next few months. So we reviewed program costs and savings projections. So we're getting down to a more detailed level, not just at a portfolio level now. And then looking at if our current programs weren't going to meet the IRP selections, then looking at what might the additional cost be to go and acquire those. And then just a few high-level findings here. We are currently soliciting bids for some of our programs for possibly new delivery vendors. So I think the residential program RFP is out currently. The commercial will be within the next few months. So that creates some uncertainty. When we have a contract in place, we have more certainty on what it's going to cost. Now that we are going out to bid, we have less certainty. We got some questions about LED cost declining, whether those were factored in. They are. So we incorporate that into our projections. But at the same time, LEDs are expected to, lighting on the whole is expected to, especially in residential, expected to be a smaller portion of the savings going forward, especially once we get to the ESA backstop or close to it. So, and because of that, we see the cost per megawatt hour forecasted for residential increasing, because non-lighting tends to be more expensive than lighting to acquire.
I just have a question.
Sure.
When do you do your budgets, and how does that coincide with the company's business plan?
Yes. So when we originally, I'm going to come to IRP first.
Okay.
So the IRP one was developed over a faster timeline.
Well, the IRP was published in March, so really February, March.
So we did a preliminary one, then we did a more detailed one just here within the past few months, and we're finalizing that actually as we speak. And so those are the numbers that we used to provide both the DSM steering committee and in here that Eli's actually going to jump to next. So the numbers that are in the IRP, they're very clear in there that they're preliminary. And then our budget, then the numbers that he's going to share here is going to be what we're expecting them to be, because we have better numbers. Because the old ones were made.
So the preliminary budget is done for the IRP years is filed in March.
Mm-hmm.
And then the updated one is.
We're going through business planning right now.
Okay. So on the next slide, we have those updated values. And in the IRP, we just have one value for each state. Here I've broken it into class one, class two, and class four. Class four is our outreach and communication. There's no savings attached to it, but we do have a budget there. So you can see the totals by year, they're a little bit higher than what was within the preliminary estimates. We're now at over the 4 years, so this is, I've narrowed it just to the action plan window. $297 million as opposed to on the previous slide, we had $262 million. So once we got to a more detailed look and looking at more at our program level forecast and updated information from our vendors and program managers, we are forecasting higher costs than what we had in the preliminary estimates.
We had a question. Does that increasing budget, does that have impacted the cost of the bundle and the measures that we see on the RFP with the money?
It wouldn't, just because that's not how we do the process. So it's really, this is some, and to some extent, this is based on what we saw selected in the RFP. So we see the RFP is selecting more LEDs. Our programs are going to be taking that guidance and shifting to LEDs. So it's really the IRP that is informing what the where our programs are going to be going, rather than the other way around.
Well, let me follow up on that though. If you're finding that your action, your more refined budget is 10% higher than your one, then wouldn't it follow that your cost bundles were potentially 10% too low? So model over select your DSM relative to the whatever the optimized price was during when this is modified or looking current.
Well, the budget doesn't come out of the IRP. It's not directly tied to the cost bundles.
No, I understand that. My point is that as you've done your more detailed budget, you're finding that it's about 10% or more higher than your preliminary budget. So to me, that's an indication that maybe the cost bundles that went into the IRP were too low, representing the cost there were too low relative to what you're finding actually is going to cost us your taxes cost.
Well, I think
that's not the process
right.
It took to get there. I'm just saying that it's a symptom or evidence of maybe an issue with how the IRP was.
I just want to add something like here. It's almost like it's a iterative process. So if based on this, we say the cost bundle may should cost of those bundles probably should be higher. So then, if we were to rerun it, the cost of other bundles that we did review may be higher also. So then the composition of the program selected in the portfolio could be different. So it's I'm not sure if there's a way to say whether these are higher, others are not. These are over under saving or not.
Yeah, I would say that these updated values are more consistent with the IRP selections than what we put in the preliminary estimates. I think the preliminary estimates probably relied a little too much on the historical acquisition rates, when what we're seeing in the IRP is that, and through our program forecast, is that the mix within the programs is going to be changing. So the IRP, I think if we had gone through this whole process after, if we had time to do it from when the IRP preferred portfolio was finalized to when the IRP was published, we would have gone through this whole process and come up with numbers that were closer here. What's in IRP Appendix D would have been closer to these numbers. And they're still pretty close, but is that?
For that, you will have the sense here, you only review updated the cost for the programs that's selected in order to re-optimize it and to reflect the more updated cost. You will have to update the cost for all of them. So if you update for all of those, the composition coming out of the selection may still be the same.
Well, we wouldn't update the cost. We think the costs are correct in the IRP coming out of the potential stuff. Not the IRP document, I mean the supply curves. The supply curves, we don't think any, this isn't saying that the supply curve costs were incorrect or too low. This is saying that once we got the selections, our preliminary estimates probably underpriced what it would actually take to go with higher numbers.
Well,
if your preliminary estimates are based on the same logic and estimates that you use to develop the hierarchy cost bundles, then it wouldn't be representative of that.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. They're really not. They're a little more tied to what we've done historically, what our programs have done, or what it's cost historically to acquire a megawatt hour.
To make Don more comfortable, it'd be interesting to look at if you were to use the IRP cost bundle figures, make a similar table so you could see the comparison between, you know, your preliminary cost, what the IRP was going to acquire it for, and then what your estimated cost. Because it sounds like that these estimated costs are pretty similar to what's the cost of the IRP. Is that what you're saying?
Well,
on orders of magnitude.
The IRP doesn't really give us costs that are comparable to these because it's levelized and they've applied their credits.
Okay.
So the things that we include as benefits in our benefit cost ratios, they have to model as decreases in costs.
Oh, okay. So
we can't really, we can't have the IRP tell us here's the cost to acquire this VSM because it's a net cost of the credits.
Gotcha.
But that's why we go through this process to look at what do we think it's actually going to cost to acquire what the IRP selected.
So if they're higher, as you're indicating or suggesting, then maybe the company would be asked not to acquire the IRP recommended DSM. I mean, that we have a process in Utah that goes through an evaluation of the proposals for DSM, and to the extent that the IRP is not reflecting what's going to happen in the real world, then I'm concerned that this isn't necessarily, that we're not doing a useful function here with what the IRP is modeling.
Let me make a quick statement here. So I was afraid that this was going to confuse people. One of the only reason this is in here is because we had a separate process through our DSM steering committee where we talked about future planning for DSM that uses the most recent information. There was a request that said, please provide the data that was provided during that steering committee during it. We have to remember the IRP process, what we went through, was based upon certain assumptions, certain things, and the budget piece was in there just for an informative piece. And it even says that within the IRP, it's informative. Those numbers are not what's driving the selections. So it was just for informational purposes, so folks that were looking at the IRP could have an estimate of what the cost would be, because there isn't a direct tie to what the IRP selects those costs for. It's only an informative piece. They aren't tied together. So I understand the concern, and I would be right with you if they were tied together, but that's kind of what Eli keeps coming back to, is that they're not.
Well, but that gets back to the issue of, you have the IRP, and we go through this lengthy, burdensome process of determining an IRP plan for the company every year, well, every 2 years. Mm-hmm. Seems like it's constant. And In the current iteration, a DSM is a major function or a major factor in how the company's going to meet its load growth for the next 10 years. And to the extent that what's going into the IRP, the data that's going into the IRP, and this seems to be what you're telling me, is preliminary, it doesn't reflect what's going to really happen. It gets back to the question, it raises a question about the value of the IRP at all.
That's a total resource question, not just a DSM question, right?
It's a total resource question, but it's important because DSM is a major part of how the company plans to meet its load growth in the next 10 years in its IRP.
Can I ask one clarifying question? When you have preliminary numbers in the IRP, and they're different than this budget estimate here, are those the numbers that tie to the bundle costs? Is there a correlation there? Are those ones that are used or not?
So I guess first let's clarify between the IRP model and the IRP document. So these costs presented here and presented in Appendix D didn't go into the IRP model. So these were costs in Appendix D that we just put them in the IRP document, as Bill mentioned, for informative purposes and preliminary estimates. And there's really no way to tie them directly to the bundles selected within the IRP because of the levelized costs and the credits applied. And it's not, what bundles are being selected by the IRP isn't saying, here's the cost to go acquire them. It's saying, here is what's cost effective based on the value and the need and the cost of the resources. Once the IRP determines that, then we go and look at what is it going to cost the DSM department to go and acquire those resources. So it's not that the information going into the IRP was preliminary. That's the final information, the best information available from our potential study. And then they're using all their best information on load forecasts, gas prices, cost of other resources, everything like that, to determine how much cost-effective and achievable DSM is included in the preferred portfolio. And then we are going on a separate process within the DSM department and saying, what would it cost? What do we think it will cost to go acquire the resources identified by the IRP?
Right, but I guess maybe if I could jump in here, maybe what I'm hearing the party say is, if you were to take those costs, which would represent, I guess, in our case, the avoided costs the company would incur, put them into the model, levelize them, and re-optimize, what would be the outcome?
Right, is there a way to reconcile, because the costs that are in the IRP are primarily, for DSM, are primarily the cost acquired, you know, some credits. So how do we reconcile that back to what it actually costs to acquire them? And that's, I think that's one of the questions we're...
Yeah, I mean,
it's 10% higher.
How can we feel comfortable that, because you're saying that the acquisition costs changed, and they potentially were higher now in their final than they were in the preliminary. So what was the acquisition cost assumed when you made the IRP bundle costs? Were they historical ones, or were they more recent ones? And I know that at some point you have to say, here are acquisition, best guess at acquisition costs, but I mean, that's what's causing, I think, the discomfort here is you don't want to be surprised when the actual cost ends up being 10% higher than what the model cost was.
Right, the IRP supply curves are developed, at least for class two, we have 50,000 measures, say 10,000 different measures in Utah. And we go through every measure and look at what's its cost, what's its savings, and then we have general assumptions about the incentive we'll pay and the administrative cost. So we're not really looking at what we paid historically there. We're having our consultant look at what is this measure cost in the market today, and then what is the likely amount that we'll have to pay to acquire it. And that's what goes into the supply curves. So it's not tied to our historical acquisition rates there. It's tied to what the potential studies updates to measure costs and assumptions about what it would take to acquire the 85%. And I think where you'll get the confidence is, that's why we do the cost effectiveness analysis. That's why we do the decrement study to look at the value. And then that's why we both, when we're looking at new programs and presenting information from programs we've run, why we present the cost relative to the value and show that these resources are cost effective within the IRP, based on the information we got from the IRP on the value of DSM.
So that the screening, the cost effectiveness screening, is the next step that really says, okay, the IRP selected it, but is this really a cost effective resource?
Right. So on the next slide, we got a request for this is also from our steering committee meeting, just preliminary look at where we think acquisitions across two are going to come from by broker or delivery channel in 2016. And so this is just to give you an idea of what we're currently looking at by program and delivery channel of savings for 2016 forecast. And these will continue to get refined. They'll be filed in November 1st. They'll be shown estimates that could differ from here a little bit. And that's all the material we have. There are a few additional slides that we included just because they were either just additional information or from the steering committee presentation which we were asked to include. And we can talk about those if there are any questions. But I did want to leave some time. I hope we have some level up 20 minutes to, if there are any additional questions either on what we presented or anything we didn't get to from the questions submitted or any other questions that have come up.
Questions from the group?
Wow.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to add, company? No, actually, those are some good questions, and appreciate your preparation and what responding to some of the questions that were asked previously. Anything else that you'd like to add? I don't know, I feel like we're shutting this down too early or something like that.
No, what you should do is go back and tell your colleagues, when I run the meeting, we end up.
Hey, that's okay.
You need to take full credit.
I wish I could. I think that's due mostly to you all. So, well, if there's nothing else, we appreciate the company coming and explaining that. And we assume that there will be a few more questions back and forth based on some of the things we've discussed today. But if there's nothing else, we'll dismiss then. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.